You will be hearing that anthem quite often starting on Thursday as NBC Sports, USA Network, and Peacock deliver approximately 31 hours of live coverage of the 126th United States Open Golf Championship at historic Shinnecock Hills Golf Club on Long Island in New York. And as we bring you this preview of the U.S. Open, we will look deeply at arguably the biggest star of the week, par 70 William Flynn designed golf course itself, with our special guest, John Bodenhamer, the Chief Championships Officer of the United States Golf Association, whose job it is to set up this course that will be hosting the U.S. Open for the sixth time. We're so pleased to have you join us. I am Kelly Elbin, your host, alongside Jenna Self, our executive producer. And in addition to John Bodenhamer's comprehensive and very thoughtful look at Shinnecock Hills, you'll hear various comments from Scottie Scheffler, Rory McIlroy, the defending champion, J.J. Spaun, and we'll pay tribute to our late and dear friend, Bob Bupka, with some words between Bob and Tiger Woods, the U.S. Open played in 2002. Well, we really have several strong storylines this week at Shinnecock Hills. I mentioned about the golf course itself. Shinnecock Hills is the only club to host the U.S. Open in three different centuries. It hosted the second U.S. Open in 1896 and four others leading up to this week, most recently 2018, when Brooks Koepka won the U.S. Open at Shinnecock at one over par. I was very fortunate in my years working at the PGA of America, working with Kerry Haig, who is the Chief Championships Officer for the PGA of America, the counterpart really for John Bodenhamer. The two of them are very good friends. And John's really, as I mentioned, going to get very deep into talking about the elements that are be a big part of this week at Shinnecock Hills. The winds, sounds like they're going to gust up to as much as 40 miles an hour on Thursday afternoon, typical winds in the daily 10 to 15 miles an hour. John talks about the U.S. Open really built for the elements. It's a firm, fast test of golf. It's going to test all 15 clubs, as he likes to talk about it, the 15th being between the ears, really that thorough mental examination. And particularly what's interesting about Shinnecock is kind of the closer you get to the hole, to each hole, the harder the course gets, because as John talks about the upside down cereal bowl designs of almost all of the greens, they just present an incredibly demanding challenge, even though it's a wider golf course off the tee. It's 48 yards in width of fairway. So driving the ball, getting it in position will not be as tough as it may have been in the past there. You're going to see the winner's going to be great iron player. He's going to be terrific around the greens, and he's going to have a lot of patience to get that U.S. Open trophy. The guy who got that done last year, let's hear from him first, was J.J. Spaun, who obviously finished with that remarkable putt on 18. But here's J.J. talking about why everything fell into place for him last year.
I think USGA wants you to get every club dirty. That's what they like to live by, and it's going to be true. It's a course where, you know, people aren't going to run away with it. You can't win it the first day, but you definitely can lose it. And I've been a guy that, you know, when I'm playing well, fairways and greens are kind of my MO. You know, it's hard to make a lot of mistakes when you're doing that pretty well, especially at a U.S. Open. And that's what I did at Oakmont. I just kind of played my game, fairways and greens. And I putted really well that week, too, and that's what led me to being in contention and ultimately winning the championship. So hopefully I can do that again this year.
And that's exactly right. Fairways and greens. And that's the very nature of the U.S. Open. J.J. Spaun and what he was saying reminds me of Andy North, who won the U.S. Open twice and really didn't capture a whole lot of other tournaments in his career. But it was fairways and greens and the patience that comes with it. And that's how you win the U.S. Open. I want to play a little tribute to my late friend, Bob Bupka, who was my partner here on Musings on Golf until we lost Bob last summer. Very, very proud Long Islander from Sag Harbor in New York. And Bob always talked about Shinnecock and how much he loved Shinnecock. I know he would be very, very pleased to see the venue looking so great as the players get ready for it. But I want to play a clip This wasn't from Shinnecock. It was from after the first round in 2002 at Bethpage Black. It was Bob interviewing Tiger Woods. And what Tiger had to say then is applicable to the players now in terms of the mindset and the approach you have to have for playing in the U.S. Open and playing well in the U.S. Open.
I've watched you since day one, Tiger. All your skills have improved, but I think today your patience out there was just tremendous.
Well, I tried to stay as patient and as I possibly could because the golf course is playing so difficult, and I hit good shots and I hit some pretty bad ones too. But you know, I hung in there, and I think that's the key to playing in a U.S. Open. You just got to hang in there. You're going to get some good lies, some good breaks, some bad lies and bad breaks, and it all evens out, but you got to stay as patient as possible.
Nobody hangs better than Tiger Woods. Congratulations. Great opening round.
Yeah, thanks, Bobby. Appreciate it, buddy.
I love Tiger closing with that, with talking about, thanks, Bobby. That's who Bob Bupka was. Always out there, working hard, and certainly the relationship he had with Tiger was absolutely fantastic. Tiger did go on to win that 2002 U.S. Open at Bethpage Black. Brooks Koepka, just a note, had issues with his hand last week. He was really struggling to figure out what it was, withdrew going into the final round of the Canadian Open, and he is scheduled to play. Adam Scott, what an incredible feat. He'll play in his 100th consecutive major golf championship this week, the only other person to play in at least 100 consecutive major championships. Well, that would be Jack Nicklaus, of course, who played in 146. So, Adam, you've only got 47 to go to beat Jack. All right, a couple of other quotes here having to do with patience. First of all, Rory McIlroy, who won the Masters earlier this year, his thoughts on what it will take to win at Shinnecock Hills.
I think it's the best championship test in the country. I think it tests all aspects of the game. Driving, iron play, you need to have your wits about you around the greens. It's a lot of strategy, thoughtfulness. It's a golf course where it can turn very quickly. You get a day like yesterday with a lot of wind and dry, clear conditions like this. And I think we're just going to have to be mindful of that as the week goes on. But It's a wonderful golf course, and looking forward to the test that it's going to provide this week.
Finally, before we get to John Bodenhamer, let's hear from the man who is trying to accomplish at this year's U.S. Open what Rory McIlroy did at last year's Masters, and that is to win a career Grand Slam of major golf championships. He's the number one ranked player in the world. Scottie Scheffler talking about, again, the patience needed at Shinnecock Hills.
I mean, a lot of it's execution. I mean, and then there's definitely an element of patience to it because you can hit some pretty decent shots and find yourself in some spots that are quite brutal, especially when you get some high winds. A lot of it just comes down to execution. But, you know, I think patience is a large part of it as well.
Patience and execution. Scottie Scheffler is spot on. I expect him to be right up there. I think you're going to see a fabulous leaderboard come Sunday. Keep going back to Matt Fitzpatrick. He won the U.S. Open at the Country Club a few years ago. He's playing well. He's got so much to his game right now. I'll take him as my pick, although, I expect to see all the top names up there. Give me Matt Fitzpatrick to win the 126th United States Open Golf Championship. Enjoy it. You'll hear from John Bodenhamer, who is the setup man for the USGA. And remember to like and subscribe to Musings on Golf on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. Right now, let's hear from the Friars Golf Club and from William and Harry Golf on their Father's Day promotion as you get ready for the U.S. Open. This Father's Day, give Dad something he'll carry for years to come. The William & Harry Whole Grain Calfskin Leather Weekender Duffel is crafted for golf trips, weekend escapes, private club weekends, business travel, and elevated everyday carry. With timeless styling and premium craftsmanship, the supple full grain calfskin leather is more than a travel bag. It's a statement piece for the modern gentleman. structured, refined, and designed to travel beautifully, each Weekender also includes a protective dust bag for the ultimate luxury experience. Now for Father's Day, the leather Weekender duffel is available for only $385. Visit WilliamAndHarry.com today and give Dad a gift that travels as well as he does. Is your golf life stuck in a bunker of country club hassles? Tired of the wait lists and the six-figure initiation fees? Well, at the Friars Golf Club, we take care of all of the hard work. Planning exclusive trips and unforgettable rounds on top-rated courses, so all you have to do is show up, have fun, and make lifelong friendships on the first tee, the 19th hole, and far beyond. Our terrific 2026 lineup includes international destinations like Dubai and Scandinavia, plus top domestic resorts such as Sand Valley and Black Desert, and access to some great private clubs. Join the Friars Golf Club today. Email us at info@thefriars.com, the word musings in the subject line, to receive a $500 trip credit when you join. We invite you to stop dreaming and start living the ultimate golf experience with the Friars Golf Club. The 126th United States Open Golf Championship will tee off in a matter of hours, and our special guest today has much to do with the way that Shinnecock Hills Golf Club will be presented to the 156 players in the field and the millions of golf fans watching around the world. He joined the USGA in June of 2011, and in his role as the association's chief championships officer, boy, oh boy, does he stay busy. He oversees all aspects of the USGA's Open Championships and the association's 10 amateur championships, international competitions, and its extensive qualifying program. It's a huge responsibility and one that we very much look forward to discussing with John Bodenhamer here on Musings on Golf. John, thanks for taking a few minutes out of your very busy schedule. Welcome to Musings on Golf. How are you?
I'm great, Kelly, and thank you for having me. It's an honor to be on with you. I know what you all do at Golf Musings and how you promote our great game, and your background with PGA of America. I'd love to chat about that a little bit, but it's been an important part of my life. All the golf professionals out there have had many mentors over the years, but it's an honor to be with you.
Well, I appreciate it. And we will talk as well about your playing career growing up out of the Pacific Northwest and what led to your days at Brigham Young University, very successful ones, and then on eventually to your time now with the USGA. Hey, John, let's just get started with Shinnecock Hills. This will be the sixth time that the US Open has gone to Shinnecock. It has the unique distinction of being the only club to host the US Open in three different centuries. It was first contested there in 1896. John, first and foremost, what makes Shinnecock one of our country's great golf courses?
Well, I think about Shinnecock Hills, it is such a special place, and it's not any one thing. It's a confluence of a number of things that make Shinnecock so special, and especially for a U.S. Open, our national championship. The architecture, you got to start with the architecture, and I'm biased. That's what I do. Golf course strategy and how we set the golf course up, among other things. But, you know, the William Flynn design, what he created there, and what the club restored about a decade ago is just truly magnificent. You think about Flynn, if you know about Flynn, he was an engineer. The way that he routed a golf course, built a golf course, was quite unique in his day. They weren't able to move as much dirt as they can today. And so he used a lot of deception and angles and even width, and a lot of that's been restored. I think the brilliancy of Flynn comes through in the architecture is just the nature of Shinnecock and its width, and it's built for the elements. It's built to be firm and fast and bouncy, and we hope to achieve that at the Open. But it all starts with the golf course, sandy based soils, where it is in our country. It's a founding member club of the USGA, one of five. Hosted the very second U.S. Open, as you said, the only club in history that's hosted in three different centuries. Think about that. That's a pretty powerful statement. America's first clubhouse in 1892, still the same building as it was then. It's and it was positioned in a place where you're playing the ninth hole or the 18th hole. You aim right at certain parts of it. It was intentional that that they did that. The history that's there. You know, our strategies and our identity around the USGA and all of our championships, not just the U.S. Open, is about going to America's greatest venues. We think of them as the cathedrals of the game because we believe it matters where players win their U.S. Open, men or women, or any of our championships. And Shinnecock has that kind of lineage. You think about Raymond Floyd winning that windswept Open in 1986, and then Corey Pavin, the shot of his life, as Johnny Miller said, in our first year with NBC, that shot in 4 would he hit into 18, which, by the way, he'll recreate this year. He'll be with us in a few days here at the club. And then, Retief Goosen, and who'll be with us as well, and then, of course, Brooks Koepka. But, you know, Shinnecock's unique in that it's a club that really represents the values of the USGA, too. They had our second U.S. Open, but they also had the U.S. Women's Amateur early on, and they were one of the few clubs in America back in the day that they were founded where women were members from day one. We're proud of that. Those values are important to us. They've hosted a Walker Cup. They've been with us from day one on our journey. And I think all that adds up, you know, the whole journey with John Shippen, the first African-American to play in an Open, and Oscar Bunn, a Shinnecock Nation player. You know, we set the tone with our values there, too. And the Open is open to everybody. It doesn't matter where you come from or you know, the clubs in your bag or the color of your skin, you can play if you can get your ball in the hole. And we're proud of that. That's what makes Shinnecock special. But I think in the end, I would say, you know, you talk to the players, and we have, I think a lot of them would say maybe Oakmont and Wingfoot are our two toughest.
Yeah.
Everybody has their own opinion. Pebble may be the place where most want to walk up the 18th fairway with a lead. It's because of the nature of what Pebble is, a national treasure. Marion might have the greatest history with Bob Jones winning the Grand Slam and Hogan hitting the one iron in 1950 after the automobile accident. Trevino's throwing the snake at Jack on the first day of the playoff. But when you talk to them, many of them will say all of that considered, Shinnecock is your finest championship venue, all things considered. It's really quite a treat to be able to be there.
And you feel that, John, don't you, when you're on the grounds there, right?
You do. You know, Kelly, it being here and knowing that an Open is going to be played in just a few days, you step out and we step out on the first tee, and there are just some places you step on that first tee and you look out over the landscape. It's just meant that a U.S. Open is played there, and Shinnecock is one of those places.
John, I'm wondering just its sheer location, fairly far out on Long Island, in terms of the weather, are there specific or unique or different challenges that the weather poses having the Open at Shinnecock on Long Island and its location, pretty far out east?
Absolutely, yes. And, that's part of the challenge, but it's also part of the charm. You know, it's a throwback place where it gets to the roots of the game, how the game was meant to be played in a link style way, in the elements, firm and fast and bouncy along the ground. Shinnecock has all of that. I think that's why many love it so much. And sandy soils. It's not just the wind, too. It's the wind direction. It can be the high sun that dries down Shinnecock. But frankly, Kelly, like no other place I've ever been. I mean, it is a place, when you think about it, depending on the wind direction, generally prevailing southwest wind. But you get that high sun and you get an 18 to 20 mile an hour wind. I've never seen a place dry down that quickly. But you think about it, all those little perched up greens, the Flint architecture, sandy soils, the wind swirling around them. It's just different than anywhere else. It dries down. It's firm and fast. And you know what? Having lived it, several U.S. Opens, just one previously in 18 on staff, there are just golf demons around that place. There are hands that come up out of those greens and swat balls off those greens, and things happen out there. But I think that's part of the unique charm of Shinnecock. It's unlike anywhere else in our country.
You mentioned about Retief Goosen winning there in 2004. He finished at 4 under par. Brooks won at 1 over par in 2018. 2018, unfortunately, notable as well with Phil Mickelson chasing after a putt and and hitting the next putt before his ball had come to rest. I'm wondering what, John, this will be, right, your second U.S. Open at Shinnecock Hills really being in charge, but particularly over those last couple of U.S. Opens, has the USGA, have you learned some things that have helped you as you get ready for this week?
I really appreciate that question, Kelly, and I think you know, we've had that a little bit leading into the championship. And, you know, I will say, yes, we have. We've learned a lot. And I was there in 18. I was part of the golf course setup team that Mike Davis led. I was actually on site at 04 early in the week and in 95. I was in a different role. I wasn't with the USGA, but I saw all of that. I've actually, you know, it's funny. I love what I do, and I punish myself sometimes. I've gone back and watch the YouTube coverage of the U.S. Open in 86, 95, 04, and 18 multiple times just to learn and relive what kind of was there. And they were all different, and the game's evolved since then. But I was the one after 18 that some of our leadership, including Mike Davis, asked, okay, take a look back. Let's talk about what happened. Do a debrief. Let's take a really open and honest internal look at this, because – look, none of us felt great about how that came off on that Saturday. Intentions were good. I was asked to kind of dig deeply, and I did. And I know exactly what happened. And I think we've learned from it. And I will tell you that there'll be a few things that'll be different this year because of it.
John, in looking back at it, was there an internal feeling at least on that Saturday, the golf course maybe got away from the USGA on that particular day?
I would say, in all honesty and to be completely transparent, I wouldn't say that the golf course got away from us, because if you watch coverage, the putting greens, if you hit a quality shot from the fairway and spun your ball, it was going to stay on the putting green.
Right.
There were some firm greens, 14 and others, but for the most part, it wasn't subsurface. But what really was the problem that when looking back at was the hydration of the leaf blade on the putting greens. So, you know, Shinnecock has these marvelous Boania, a little bit of bent grass putting greens. And when you get windy conditions, sustained winds of 20 to 25 miles an hour, and you get a high sun, 78 degrees, man, that place dries down quickly. And we learned from that, but it was really about the leaf blade. And we just didn't have enough hydration in the leaf blade to get us through the day. And what you saw on holes like, hole 15, hole 18 in particular that I think back on, it was almost as if around the hole, especially if you look back at the coverage, things had gotten just crispy and almost glassy around the hole because of foot traffic and because the leaf blade was just too crispy and didn't have enough hydration in it. And so I think we'll think about things a little differently this year than going into this. We're prepared in a way to go in. And I'll give you three things. One, when we were preparing for an open in 2018, we would want the guys to show up on Monday or Tuesday and see the golf course as they would see it through the whole week. And at Shinnecock, that's hard to do. That's hard to do at any U.S. Open venue, any of our championship venues, but maintain championship conditions for an entire week. Now we think about how do we ease into it a little bit more? Maybe by Wednesday or Thursday, we're starting to see the greens and the golf course firm up the way we want it. Green speeds kind of ease into it where we want them. Not try to maintain it Monday through Sunday, but maybe Wednesday, Thursday, and we get into the weekend, we're peaking, you know, and we've talked to a lot of the players about that. That's what they seem to expect. I think you'll see more width this year at Shinnecock than we had in 18, which was a very wide U.S. Open, even in 2018, 42-yard average fairways. This year, we're going to be at about 48 yards wide. But there's an intentionality behind that. That's what William Flynn intended. USGA came in and narrowed those up in 18. In 2004, we were about 26, 27 yards wide. We narrowed it up a lot. And there were bunkers 20, 30 yards into the rough that never came into play. We're not going to do that this year. You're going to see, really, I think in any U.S. Open we've conducted, the first real William Flynn designed golf course at Shinnecock. And then lastly, we'll maintain the green speeds a little bit slower. And if we need to, we're going to put a little bit more water on the putting greens to maintain the proper playing surfaces.
John, you mentioned about sort of building into that opening round. Does the game plan at all, does the thinking for the USGA change at all from round to round based on how scores may be, how players may be playing on Thursday? Does that impact the way the golf course is set up on Friday?
I would say it's not really based on score. It's not score dependent for us. I think maybe there was a day where it was with the USGA, to be totally honest with you. I think par was, you know, the thought that, you know, a U.S. Open is the winner is generally at even par. That's not the way we think about it anymore. I'll come back to that. What really our setup is dependent on, we go in with a game plan, but it's a real-time decision day-to-day based on the weather. You know, I think in particularly wind and wind direction and speed. Shinnecock has putting greens, number 7, number 9, number 11, number 18, probably a few others where you just don't see slope that's under 4%. It's all 4 or 5, 6%. That is incredibly severe. And so when you get green speeds in the 12, so to speak, and you get some wind coming out a particular direction and that wind is going downhill and a ball just won't stop in that wind direction, we've got to pivot. And so we'll be watching those things very closely. You know, hole locations combined with wind speed, green speed, wind direction. And so I think what we do, Kelly, is we'll go in with a game plan a year or so out. We'll modify it into the spring of that year based on how the golf course comes out of the winter. And then the week before, we'll fine tune it. And then the week of, it's a day-to-day decision. It's largely baked out, but we'll make minor fine-tune nuanced decisions so that we provide a challenging test, but a fair test.
John, you mentioned about the slope. To give our listeners a comparison, if you will, we're just coming off the PGA Championship at Aronimink, which held up very, very well. How do the greens at Shinnecock Hills, from a slope standpoint, how do they compare to what the players struggled with, quite honestly, at Aronimink?
I'm so glad you asked that. As you know, Kerry Haig is a dear friend of mine, and I'm a great admirer of Kerry. I think he's the dean of what we do in the game, and I respect Kerry so much. And I really thought what he did at Aronimink was fantastic. I was there Tuesday and Wednesday, and I think the width that he had kind of lulled the guys into taking driver most of the time. But then, you know, You had to play from the short grass, really in windy conditions, to get to those hole locations, be able to spin your ball. And I think today's players, you know, they have their own strategies where, you know, it really is they try to hit it down there as close as they can to the green, fairway or rough, regardless, and then you know, either chunk and run it on or control their spin. I think Kerry played into that with those hole locations. Boys hit it in the fairway, and finally, you know, Aaron Rye and Alex Smalley, they kind of figured it out, and we'll do a little of that at Shinnecock, but. I thought the PGA was brilliant. I commend Kerry. I think that's right, though. I think that Shinnecock will be a little bit that way. I think it's different in that the holes at Aronimink had a lot of slope on them, old fashioned Donald Ross putting greens. Shinnecock's a little bit different. They're more, while Aronimink were crowned, there were more sections of those greens that had different variety to them. Shinnecock is a little bit different that way. They're more upside down cereal bowls. Mm-hmm. And there's more false sides and fronts, and we pay close attention to that. And so I think from our strategic standpoint, you know, our strategies are, we want it to be tough. We want it to be fair. And that doesn't mean par is a winning score. It means we want the players to get every club in their bag dirty when they win. And what do I mean by that? Well, we want them to get all 15 clubs dirty, the 14 in their bag and the one between their ears. And so we'll challenge them to hit shots with the way we'll set the golf course up, with angles and variety of yardages and things where they've got to move the ball left to right to get to a hole location or right to left. They've got to think about not just how they hit the ball and what it does in the air and the wind or no wind, but what it does when it hits the ground. And you look at Shinnecock, and it's so marvelous, as I mentioned, upside down cereal bowls. There'll be a lot of things that players will encounter at Shinnecock, but the most important to us are choices. And you look at holes like 4 and 5 and 6 and 7 and all through the back nine, 10 especially, and 11, where these putting greens, you get it off and they're running around these putting greens in these closely mown areas that were the Flynn architecture. we think the choices that the players have of either putting, bump and running it, or pitching it up in the air is brilliant. And we're going to give them all of those choices and give them conditions where they can choose to do what they want. We know in talking to the very best players that they don't like choices. They want to answer one question. We give them choices. Now they got to think about it a little bit more. Yep. And that's what I mean about the 15th club, the mental examination, not just what they do with shot making.
Well, that's what any great major championship should be about. So pleased to be joined by John Bodenhamer, the Chief Championships Officer for the United States Golf Association, as we prepare for the 126th U.S. Open. I always know what Open is going to be, John, by the year. It just happened. It finally
fits. Right, yeah.
It's the 126th of the year 2026. You mentioned Kerry Hegg, a longtime golf course setup man for the PGA of America. I worked there for a number of years. I always admired, Kerry oversaw a number of championships that the PGA of America ran. John, I mentioned early on at the outset, you and your team are responsible for 15 championships. You have, what, 5 open championships and 10 amateur championships. You mentioned Marion, the U.S. amateur, will be played later this year at that great club outside of Philadelphia. John, you must have a terrific team. There has to be so many moving parts when you're overseeing that many big-time events.
Oh, no question about it, Kelly. I do serve as our chief championships officer. My main focus is around the inside the ropes and the build with our opens, the men's open and the women's open. But boy, we have a great team. You know, people like Jeff Hall, who's been at 36 consecutive U.S. Opens, Brent Palladino, who's a fine player in his own right, Scott Langley, who played on tour for 10 years, and Darren Brevard, our agronomist. That's our U.S. Open setup team. But people like Shannon Roulard, who sets the golf course up for the Women's Open at Riviera, which is going to be magnificent, which was magnificent this past week. And I think she'll be on our team at Shinnecock this coming week. And I could go on and on. It's really a great team. And, there's no way that one person can do it. It's a team effort. And I would say all of our championships have their own personality, their own host venues. You know, our strategies are to take some of them to similar venues. You know, we'll take an open, a women's open, an amateur to Marion. We'll do the same at Oakmont. We'll do the same at Pinehurst and so on and so forth. And there's a rhyme and a reason to that. You know, playing an amateur or an open, every time we play at one of our championships, we get better the next time. And that's really a strategy of continuous improvement. But we've got a great team. They're an experienced team. We have a lot of young, talented people that are coming in and being mentored by them. So the future is bright. We're really proud of the female talent that we've cultivated too. And we work hard on succession, and it's paying dividends.
John, I'm so pleased that we can spend this time previewing the 2026 U.S. Open and talking about your career. Right now, we'll take a quick break to hear from our friends at William & Harry Golf. Then we'll come back and continue our terrific conversation. This Father's Day, give Dad something he'll carry for years to come. The William & Harry Full Grain Calfskin Leather Weekender Duffel is crafted for golf trips, weekend escapes, private club weekends, business travel, and elevated everyday carry. With timeless styling and premium craftsmanship, the supple full-grain calfskin leather is more than a travel bag. It's a statement piece for the modern gentleman. Structured, refined, and designed to travel beautifully, each weekender also includes a protective dust bag for the ultimate luxury experience. Now for Father's Day, the Leather Weekender Duffel is available for only $385. Visit williamandharry.com today and give Dad a gift that travels as well as he does. John, I mentioned the U.S. Amateur being played at Marion. You played in 2 U.S. Amateurs. You had a terrific playing career as a young man in the Pacific Northwest, winning the Pacific Northwest Junior Championship, the Washington State Junior Championship, the Washington State Amateur.
You even won the Alaska State Open a couple of times.
But John, I have to imagine, as much of a thrill as that was, to be on the very first BYU sports team of any kind to win a national championship outright. The 1981 Division I national NCAA national team winners. How proud that must be. And you had a terrific team. You had some great teammates as well.
Kelly, it's a very kind question. And it's true. We did. We had some great teams. Our golf coach, Carl Tucker, who's no longer with us, but was a true great mentor to me and to everybody else in that team. He was a second father figure to me in so many ways. But, you know, I feel so blessed to have played on the team, that NCAA championship team in 1981. You know, I think about people that I still stay in close touch with, like Dick Sokol, had a 20-plus year career, a two-time winner on the tour. Rick Fair, multiple winner on the tour, a Seattle guy, kind of like me, and Keith Clearwater, who was Rookie of the Year, won a couple times. I mean, I think about those guys and stay in touch with them and others, you know, that maybe didn't play on tour, but were uber talented. And it was just a great place to be to play golf. And, you know, I think about that year after winning, and it was such a big achievement for BYU that it really set the tone for the athletic department. And, you know, BYU prides itself on its athletics and so on. And it was just really a rallying cry. It also was, you know, the next year, there was a lot of pressure everywhere we went. Well, you know, they won the national championship and, you know, we were expected to play pretty well. And that was kind of a new experience, but those teams were great to be a part of. And I'll always feel grateful for the relationships they go on. You know, it was an interesting year too. I think back that year. And if I remember, I have this right. I think there were some at BYU that felt, well, we won the national golf championship. And earlier in the year, our football team under Jim McMahon had beat Southern Methodist University. Danny Ainge led the basketball team had beat Notre Dame, and we had beaten Oral Roberts in the NCAA championship. So, you know, there was this sort of divine intervention sort of concept.
Very much, right? BYU
being an LDS school so on. I say that tongue in cheek, but it was kind of a funny thing we still talk about these days. It meant a lot to the school and the athletic department to win that national championship. And it really was something that, so many relationships because of it.
John, what led up to the opportunity that you had to join the USGA in the summer of 2011?
Well, my goodness, Kelly, I played in college at BYU, and Carl Tucker was a mentor. And, you know, and I go back and I know your history, Kelly. You mentioned your work with the PGA of America not all that long ago. I also know your family history with PGA of America. Your father was a 50-year golf professional at one of America's great clubs and president of the PGA of America through a pretty unique time that the organization went through. And
no question.
So,
about
you
it.
Know, and I want to give a shout out. And now that I think of it, I think about your dad and I think about you and I think about Kerry Haig and the PGA of America. And I just want to give a shout out to the organization. You know, we're very proud of what we do at the USGA, but I'm a guy who grew up with a great PGA golf professional, a guy by the name of, I don't know if you or any of your listeners would have ever known him, a guy by the name of George Lanning. He was president of the Pacific Northwest section.
Yes.
Left-handed player. He played on what was the senior tour for a number of years. He took me under his wing, never charged me for a lesson, just believed in me. It was Mr. He knew everything about the rules. He was a great businessman. He was a consummate golf professional. A guy by the name of Ron Hagen opened our golf course in the Pacific Northwest when I was with the Pacific Northwest Golf Association that we bought from Weyerhaeuser, president section. I'm a fan of the PGA of America and what they do every single day to benefit our great game. And I just want to shout out to, sure, there are a few of your listeners that are golf professionals or come out of that background. And I grew up playing with those guys. I still admire all of them. And there's more, and I could tell you stories. But, I think that coming to the USGA, that's where my journey began. I played competitively. You mentioned a few of those wins. Those are great memories. And being able to go to BYU. BYU set the tone for me. Carl Tucker taught us how to dress. Taught us the importance of first impressions. He pushed us out there to speak in public in so many instances, what the meaning of integrity and honor meant and how it's not winning, it's how you win, and what was most important. And I'll never forget that. And then my journey went into a little different direction. I played professionally for 2 years and gave that up because I couldn't hit that 2-iron up in the air with a high draw like a lot of guys could, like Freddie Couples, who I grew up with good, and went on to the U.S. Senate and worked for a senator in Washington, D.C. for 2 years, and then got a phone call in my office back there saying the Pacific Northwest Golf Association was looking for a new executive director. And I turned it down twice. And I finally agreed to get this person off my back, submit a resume. And I finally did to get her off my back. And I got the job and spent the next 23 years of my life, just an amazing ride for me. And I got to know the USGA at that time. I served on a number of committees, got to know people like Jim Hyler and Tom O'Toole and Mike Davis and Mike Butts and David Fay, and built those relationships. And when the organization hired Mike Davis as our CEO, Mike called me and said, I want you to be a part of my senior team. And it was a great honor for somebody that grew up steeped in the traditions of the USGA and the US Open. I always wanted to play in the US Open, got to final qualifying a couple times, but never played. It was just an honor of a lifetime.
What did you learn in working for a few years for the great Senator Orrin Hatch?
I think building, I think from Orrin, who was a man that, had great integrity. And it was really about building relationships. It wasn't necessarily consensus, because Orrin would lead when he needed to lead and he'd take a stand. He was a strong leader. But you think about Orrin Hatch, I remember going back there, and I found it very fascinating when I first went back there that Orrin Hatch had run on a platform in Utah to go back in 1976 when he ran to go back and fight Ted Kennedy's agenda in the Senate.
Yeah.
They became the closest of friends when he went back. Yeah. And you think about it, Kelly, when Orrin Hatch and Ted Kennedy would co-sponsor a bill, it would sail through the Senate because it was a compromise and it was something that was good for both sides. That's pretty rare these days. And I admired that. And I think that taught me a lot about relationships. And while we may have our differences, there's always commonalities and you can always come together in ways. And I think we try to do that at the USGA today. I think I subconsciously live that, even with what we do with our host venues, why we're able to go out 20 plus years, could have a US Open in 2051 at Oakland Hills. Well, why would we do that? Well, where else would we conduct it other than where the 100th anniversary where Hogan tamed the monster? But, you know, it's all about trust. It's all about relationships, everything we do. And I think that's what Orrin gave me the most.
And I mentioned the U.S. Amateur being played at Marion. You played in two U.S. Amateurs. You had a terrific playing career as a young man in the Pacific Northwest, winning the Pacific Northwest Junior Championship, the Washington State Junior Championship, the Washington State Amateur. You even won the
Alaska State Open a couple of times.
But John, I have to imagine, as much of a thrill as that was to be on the very first
BYU
sports team of any kind to win a national championship outright, the 1981 Division I NCAA national team winners, how proud that must be. And you had a terrific team. You have some great teammates as well.
Kelly, it's a very kind question. And, it's true. We did. We had some great teams, our golf coach, Carl Tucker, who's no longer with us, but was a true great mentor to me and to everybody else on that team. He was a second father figure to me in so many ways. But, you know, I feel so blessed to have played on the team, that NCAA championship team in 1981. You know, I think about people that I still stay in close touch with, like Dick Sokol, had a 20-plus year career, two-time winner on the tour, Rick Fair, multiple winner on the tour, a Seattle guy, kind of like me, and Keith Clearwater, who was Rookie of the Year, won a couple times. I mean, I think about those guys and stay in touch with them and others, you know, that maybe didn't play on tour, but were uber talented. And it was just a great place to be, to play golf. And, you know, I think about that year after winning, and it was such a big achievement for BYU that, it really set the tone for the athletic department, and you know, BYU prides itself on its athletics and so on. It was just really a rallying cry. It also was, you know, the next year there was a lot of pressure everywhere we went. Well, you know, they won the national championship, and you know, we were expected to play pretty well, and that was kind of a new experience. But those teams were great to be a part of, and I'll always feel grateful for the relationships they go on. You know, it was an interesting year too. I think back that year, and if I remember, I have this right, I think there were some at BYU that felt, well, we won the National Golf Championship, and earlier in the year, our football team under Jim McMahon had beat Southern Methodist University. Danny Ainge led basketball team had beat Notre Dame, and we had beaten Oral Roberts in the NCAA championship. So, you know, there was this sort of divine intervention sort of concept.
Very much, right?
Being an LDS school and so on. I say that tongue in cheek, but it was kind of a funny thing we still talk about these days. It meant a lot to the school and the athletic department to win that national championship. And it really was something that, so many relationships because of it.
John, what led up to the opportunity that you had to join the USGA in the summer of 2011?
Well, my goodness, Kelly, I played in college at BYU, and Carl Tucker was a mentor. And I go back, and I know your history, Kelly. You mentioned your work with the PGA of America not all that long ago. I also know your family history with the PGA of America. Your father was a 50-year golf professional at one of America's great clubs, and president of the PGA of America through a pretty unique time that the organization went through. And
no question.
I want to give a shout out. And now that I think of it, I think about your dad, and I think about you, and I think about Kerry Haig and the PGA of America. And I just want to give a shout out to the organization. You know, we're very proud of what we do at the USGA, but I'm a guy who grew up with a great PGA golf professional, a guy by the name of, I don't know if you or any of your listeners would have ever known him, a guy by the name of George Lanny. He was president of the Pacific Northwest section.
Yeah.
Left-handed player. He played on what was the senior tour for a number of years. He took me under his wing, never charged me for a lesson, just believed in me. It was Mr. He knew everything about the rules. He was a great businessman. He was a consummate golf professional. A guy by the name of Ron Hagen opened our golf course in the Pacific Northwest when I was with the Pacific Northwest Golf Association that we bought from Weyerhaeuser, president section. I'm a fan of the PGA of America and what they do every single day to benefit our great game. And I just want to shout out to, sure there are a few of your listeners that are golf professionals or come out of that background. And I grew up playing with those guys. I still admire all of them. And there's more, and I could tell you stories. But, I think that... coming to the USGA, that's where my journey began. I played competitively. You mentioned a few of those wins. Those are great memories. And being able to go to BYU. BYU set the tone for me. Carl Tucker taught us how to dress, taught us the importance of first impressions. He pushed us out there to speak in public in so many instances, what the meaning of integrity and honor meant, and how it's not winning, it's how you win. And what was most important, and I'll never forget that. And then my journey went into a little different direction. I played professionally for 2 years and gave that up because I couldn't hit that 2-iron up in the air with a high draw like a lot of guys could, like Freddie Couples, who I grew up with, could. And went on to the U.S. Senate and worked for a senator in Washington, D.C. for 2 years, and then got a phone call in my office back there saying the Pacific Northwest Golf Association was looking for a new executive director. And I turned it down twice, and I finally agreed to get this person off my back, submit a resume. And I finally did to get her off my back, and I got the job and spent the next 23 years of my life. Just an amazing ride for me. And I got to know the USGA at that time. I served on a number of committees, got to know people like Jim Tyler and Tom O'Toole and Mike Davis and Mike Butts and David Fay, and built those relationships. And when the organization hired Mike Davis as our CEO, Mike called me and said, I want you to be a part of my senior team. And it was a great honor for somebody that grew up steeped in the traditions of the USGA and the US Open. Always wanted to play in the US Open, got to final qualifying a couple times, but never played. It was just an honor of a lifetime.
What did you learn in working for a few years for the great Senator Orrin Hatch?
I think building, I think from Orrin, who was a man that, had great integrity. It was really about building relationships. It wasn't necessarily consensus, because Orrin would lead when he needed to lead and he'd take a stand. He was a strong leader. But you think about Orrin Hatch, I remember going back there, and I found it very fascinating when I first went back there that Orrin Hatch had run on a platform in Utah to go back in 1976 when he ran to go back and fight Ted Kennedy's agenda in the Senate.
Yeah.
They became the closest of friends. Yeah. And he went back. Yeah. And you think about it, Kelly, when Orrin Hatch and Ted Kennedy would co-sponsor a bill, it would sail through the Senate because it was a compromise and it was something that was good for both sides. That's pretty rare these days. And I admired that. And I think that taught me a lot about relationships. And while we may have our differences, there's always commonalities and you can always come together in ways. And I think we try to do that at the USGA today. I think I subconsciously live that even with what we do with our host venues, why we're able to go out 20 plus years to have a US Open in 2051 at Oakland Hills. Well, why would we do that? Well, where else would we conduct it other than where the 100th anniversary where Hogan tamed the monster? But, you know, it's all about trust. It's all about relationships, everything we do. And I think that's what Orrin gave me the most.
John Bodenhamer, I'm wondering, in the year for the U.S. Open, this past year, how often have you traveled back and forth to Shinnecock? Do you go once a month, how often?
I think from the way we look at it, Kelly, is from U.S. Open to U.S. Open. We were there at Shinnecock a couple weeks after the U.S. Open last year at Oakmont. And then we made three more visits in the fall. I personally was a part of. We have an engagement, a town hall with the members. And then we're out in the spring twice, once for media day, which was a few weeks ago. My team is out there a little more frequently. We have my operations team, Reg Jones and his team, who build all the facilities, are out there. We have on-site team that's out there every day. It has been for 2.5 years. Our inside the ropes team, we're out there about every month. I'll go out right after the U.S. For media day and stayed a few extra days and then arrived on site here after the Women's Open last week, and we'll be here for the duration, of course. But it's generally a 2 to 3 year journey, but with Shinnecock, it started right after 2018.
John, final question relative to this championship. You mentioned earlier about Johnny Miller's note about Corey Pavin's shot of his life. You had a short hitter, therefore, in Corey Pavin winning in 95. You had a very long hitter in Brooks winning in 18. I'm wondering, do you go about trying to find a balance in setup for whether it's Shinnecock or any U.S. Open venue between the quote, shorter hitter and the quote, bomber? To try to make it as equitable as it can be for any type of player?
I think we do think about, we don't want to advantage any one type of player, but I think it's really more about, our strategies are trying to get the players to examine every part of their game. And it's not necessarily somebody that's longer or shorter, and they have different strategies. These guys today, they know the 60-yard cone, the further, the closer they can hit the putting green, and the better their odds are of scoring. But I do think that there are certainly equalizers to that, and so it really comes down to the weather, most importantly. And I think, as I said before, if we get a little bit of wind and rain, the course will be a little more scoring resistant. If we don't, then it's going to be a little more scoring receptive. We don't really think about score. We think more about what we're putting in front of them hole by hole, mm-hmm. and the shots that we're asking them to play and testing and having them hit every club and think about things differently. And frankly, experience what every player in every U.S. Open before them has experienced, from Bob Jones to Ben Hogan, to Arnold Palmer, to Jack Nicklaus, to Tiger Woods, to J.J. Spahn. I will say, Kelly, I do think Shinnecock is a bit different in this respect. And I don't think it's on us as much we do, but I think this will be a place, and you think about the Flynn architecture. Flynn had, if you look at the routing, there are three triangles, brilliant setup routing, three triangles. I want to think about this now, 4, 5, and 6. 10, 11, 12, and 13, and 14, 15, and 16. They're triangles, intentionally triangles out in the routing. And when you think about it, the prevailing wind being from the southwest, playing those triangular routing of holes, players are going to see every wind direction. Yeah. Downwind, into the wind, crosswind, left to right, right to left. That's brilliant. But my point is that somebody that goes out thinking that they're going to play nine holes on Tuesday and nine holes on Wednesday, if they played in prevailing wind, then the wind shifts to come out of the east. Good luck. It's a whole different golf course. Partly because of the architecture and partly the way that it lays out. In fact, when the wind comes out of the east, members, they don't even go out and play. They just stay in the clubhouse and play cards. It's that kind of thing. It's that difficult. So it's going to be interesting. I think the player that prepares and thinks about it maybe has come out and seen a few different winds. If the winds do switch, I think they'll have a definite advantage.
Did was that those triangles that you talked about, did he purposely create them that way because of the effect of the wind, Mr. Flynn?
He did, and it's brilliant. And you see very little of that. And I think you'll also see things. I do believe 9, 10, and 11 are going to be definitive to the championship. You look back, as I have it, at previous U.S. Opens at Shinnecock, 16 has been a pivotal hole, generally with a birdie. It was for Raymond Floyd. It was for Retief Goosen and Phil Mickelson. Phil doubled 17 and 04. But, I think 9, 10, and 11 and 16 will be pivotal. But I think those triangular holes, depending on what the wind does, if the wind chooses to come out of a different direction than the prevailing southwest, we'll see who has prepared appropriately. Or if it rains and we get a little bit softer conditions and it's not bouncy, I think somebody that's really done their homework will really benefit from that. We may not see it. Like I said, Mother Nature has a seat at the table. But boy, wouldn't it be fun if things switch up a little bit?
Absolutely. Would you be willing to wager a winning score? I understand the variables of what you're saying about the weather, but how about a ballpark pick on the winning score, John?
Well, you're a good man, Kelly. I learned long ago not to predict a particular number because, in all honesty, I'll say two things. One, it is all weather dependent. We get 25 mile an hour sustained gusts. It's going to be hard. It's a hard golf course. It just is. And, I think we'll set it up accordingly. And I'd say this. I think we want it to be about this great venue and these great players, not about anything we do to the golf course. That we want to fly under the radar. And we want them to showcase their skills. But I will say this. I think that the winner will be under par. And you think about the history of the U.S. Open in Shinnecock. There have only been three players that have finished under par in the history. Going back to 1896. Raymond Floyd in 86 was one unders, I believe, and then Retief was four, and Phil was two in 04. Nobody else has been under par. I do think things have changed. We look at driving distances. I think that'll be different too this year. Players are hitting it on average 7 yards further. That's going to make a difference in two ways. I think you'll see more people be aggressive on number five, the par five in the front, and I think you're going to see a lot more golf balls spinning on the wind. Which on 16, which Sharon plays into the wind. But I think you're going to see more golf balls on that green and two or around the green and two than we did. And I think you'll see different approach shots, more shorter clubs in. And I think that's going to impact our pace of play. We're going to have a little bit longer pace of play too. And we're just, our simulations have indicated that. But I'll share one thing Curtis Strange said to me after 2018. Curtis is a dear friend, two-time U.S. Open champ. And he said, John, can we chat about the U.S. Open? I want to share something with you. This is a senior open at the Broadmoor a few weeks after Shinnecock in 18. I said, sure, Curtis. We sat down for 2 hours. He said, John, I just want to say to you that when I won my back-to-back U.S. Opens in 88 and 89 at the Country Club and at Oak Hill Country Club, they defined my career. The U.S. Open is the most important championship to me, but it's different today. Now, this is back in 18. This is what Curtis said. It's different today. When I won, there was a limited number of guys that were probably going to have the ability to win on a U.S. Open championship test. Today, that's different. These players, they're bigger, stronger, faster. They're better coached. They have better equipment, maintenance practices, golf ball fairways are maintained the way some callers were around putting greens years ago. And there are just way more of those good players and good athletes. They train better. And so, John, I wonder, when a U.S. Open winner isn't under par, what happened? Did you have a weather event that really forced that, the elements? Or was it something you forced a score with setup? And it really resonated with me, Kelly. I got to tell you, because I admire Curtis a lot. There was a guy who thought his way around a golf course like nobody's business. But, you know, it made sense. Why would we force a score with setup and push hole locations? Then it becomes about us. It should be about these great venues. It should be about these great players. And the last thing I'll say to you is I think we're on a journey right now. I think people will see this week a U.S. Open that is wide. But don't be fooled by that. If we get the wind and we get bounciness, it won't play as wide as it seems. And that's what we're going to endeavor to do. But I think Curtis is right. I think these players are so good today that far be it from us to try to deter them from showing why they're the world's greatest players. So we're going to let Shinnecock be Shinnecock. We're going to let it shine, and we're going to let these players show their great skills. And whatever the score is, well, it'll depend on the weather, but we think Shinnecock will hold up and it'll be what it's going to be.
John, this has been an absolutely fabulous interview. Let me close with, I know that a lot of people share the fact that the final round of the U.S. Open always falls on Father's Day. And yes. and the special nature of that. I always ask at the end of my interviews here, who would round out your dream foursome? You know, who would be three people with whom you'd play a really special round of golf, whether they're no longer with us or whether they're walking the fairways of our game today? And I certainly think about my dad as part of that group, right? I'm wondering for you, who rounds out John Bodenhamer's really wonderful three people, and what golf course do you go and play at for that magical round?
Well, the second part of that question, I could get in a whole lot of trouble answering that, but I'll answer it because I do get that question quite a bit. You know, I'll tell you, I'll share something with you here after this. I'll answer your question. That's a hard one, but I'll answer it this way. I think for me, if I think about where I'd like to play the most, or maybe the final time I get to play for whatever reason, I think for me, the three that I would choose would be my father introducing to the game, and my two brothers who are no longer with us. But I know I'll see them again one day. And then I think about my son and daughter as well. And so I'll give you two places. I think if I had one round to play or could choose one place, it would be Cypress Point. And I say that because I love Cypress Point, but I say it not only because I love Cypress Point, but because I have so many great memories of Cypress Point. Guys, we'd play in college there, just memories from years ago, people I played with there, the days that we had, the memories, as much as that, you know, to me, maybe the greatest architecture in the world, you know, the use of land and sea and pine trees and forest and terrain, Alistair McKenzie, it's just brilliant when you dissect it. But it's really the memories and being able to traverse that one more time with my dad and my brother. But I'll tell you what, if I had a week to go, it was my final place to play for a whole week, I'd go to Bandon Dunes Golf Resort. Yeah. Because I think that's the best variety in our country. And all due respect to all of our children. We love them all. You know, Pinehurst, Pebble Beach, Oakmont, Marion, Oakland Hills, the Country Club, Wingfoot, LA Country Club, Riviera. I could go on and on where we're taking the U.S. Open and the U.S. Women's Open. Chicago Golf Club, Interlochen, you know, there's so many good ones. But Bandon Dunes to me, and what Mike Kaiser has built there, and a tribute to amateur golf and the variety and the way golf should be played, to me is just where every time I go there, it's an out of body experience for me. And I could, from the first time I visited in 1998, it just means a lot to me and what Bandon Dunes stands for. And so, that'd be the one I'd play with my son and daughter, and probably have my wife Pam walking around with us. That would be the two. I'd answer that.
Fantastic responses again, John Bodenhamer. Thank you so much for your time. I know that the golfers are ready. I know the spectators on site, and as I mentioned, the millions of people watching worldwide couldn't be any more excited to bring the Open back to such a fabled place as Shinnecock Hills. And it has to be, I would imagine for you, just a great honor to be involved with the USGA at such a special place, as we're just about ready to see the first ball go up in the air.
I'll say two things in closing, Kelly. One is I was a young boy who grew up on a golf course. And as a 13, 14, 15 year old, like a lot of little boys and girls, I grew up on a golf course and our family home was behind third green. And I would play home in the summer months every night after cleaning the carts and picking the range or caddying. And every night when the shadows were getting long and the sun was going down, I always had a final putt on that third green. It was always for one thing, to win one championship, just one, every night, U.S. Open. And to do what I do now, it's the ultimate honor of my life. And, I think a lot of little boys are, and little girls are inspired by those stories. We can all relive them. And when they watch these great champions, we hope it inspires them in a U.S. Open or a U.S. Women's Open. And so I would say, too, that for a place like Shinnecock to give the USGA, they are a USGA club, and to give us the honor of coming to their links to play our National Open and be a founding member club, we don't take that for granted. And they have been most gracious, and they have rolled out the red carpet, and these players are going to feel it this week. And I can't wait to get started. Let's get balls in the air.
And those golf balls will be flying for real as the first round of the United States Open Golf Championship at Shinnecock Hills is just hours away. Can't thank John Bodenhamer enough for his insights, his passion for the game. Hope you all learned a lot from John. Next week, as we recap the 126th U.S. Open Championship, we'll be joined by Mark Cannizzaro, the longtime golf writer for the New York Post. It's a home game for Mark this week. I know he'll have a lot to say and report on, as we'll have a U.S. Open champion for 2026 in the books. Enjoy your playing of our national championship. I know that the Dean, Jenna Self, and I will do the same. Hunker down on the couch. Get ready. Balls are just about in the air as the U.S. Open begins at Shinnecock Hills. And thank you for joining us on Musings on Golf.